Podcast Ain't Played Nobody, Peisman Trophy Special, coming to you live and in living color from Culver Stockton College in Missouri. We are with Andrew Rupsich, esteemed award winner of the Peisman Trophy winner. I've got Andrew with me. We'll call him Roop. And I also have Ryan Nanny at Celebrity Hot Tub on Twitter, Banner Society Zone. We are Podcast Ain't Played Nobody, part of the Banner Society Network. Roop, congratulations, first and foremost, on being the 2019 winner of the Peisman Trophy.
Thank you, guys. It was an awesome experience.
Cool, man. With Ryan, we flew into St. Louis. Yeah, or I flew into St. Louis yesterday, drove out here today. We're going to hang out with Roop a little bit and talk about the play that won him the award. If you haven't seen it, it'll be on my Twitter, at RJ_rights. It's on the Peisman Trophy Twitter, Banner Society Twitter. Basically, Roop takes, a throwback screen and throws it, roughly 50 yards?
Yeah, it came out to like 47 yards, I believe. One pass, 47 yards, so not too bad.
So if your stat line forever reads 1 of 1, 47 yards, you cool with that?
I want to do it again, but I'm cool with that, to be honest. My passer rating is like 1,039 right now.
That's what I like to hear. So I guess take us through the play and how you guys implemented it. How many times did you – first of all, what's it called?
Oh, it's called Gut.
Okay.
Good name.
It's called Gut because I always, during like practices before games, I always pull my shirt up. So it's always just my gut hanging out. They call it Belly Boy sometimes. But that's how they got named.
So it's called Gut. It's a shotgun formation, and you are at left tackle. I'm trying to kind of paint the picture. We always say podcasting is a visual medium on our show. So you're at left tackle. You feign a block, and then you kind of get, I guess, perpendicular to the quarterback, receive the pass, and then throw it deep to a wide receiver on the left side, down the left sideline, near the end zone. Not actually a touchdown, but you do end
I'm
up scoring.
It looks like a touchdown to me.
Exactly. You know? That's fine. That's fine with me.
At first I did. I was running down the sideline, like celebrating like the when Pat McAfee runs down the sideline flailing his arms. I was doing that. You can see it from a different angle. But yeah, because we have a play where it's like a sprint out. It's basically the same sprint out formation and everything just releases out after that.
I was going to ask you, so you guys set this play up throughout the game, throughout the season?
Yeah, it's through our sprint out protection. We have a lot of stuff where it's that trip formation, trip, and then the one on the left side where we just have a whole sprint out. The backside is kind of like a waterfall technique. And then once I got back far enough, it was just like a turnaround.
So you are typically releasing to block at like the second level?
No, it's just a straight waterfall back to the quarterback, just protecting his backside.
Got it.
Like normal, so.
Got it. So how did you guys, were you kind of pining for this? Like what was the implementation of Gut? Is this something that had been in the playbook from like training camp or like how did that work?
So the way it worked out freshman year, I'm guessing it was like a way to kind of make me happy freshman year. when I came in, it was a play, same technique, same everything. And what it was a just a pass back, and then it was the guard came out just like it was, but it was a run play strictly. I guess they didn't trust me enough to throw it yet.
so you would do that. What and explain waterfall technique really quick, just for our audience.
It's essentially just like you're taking a couple steps in, you're backpedaling towards the direction of the quarterback, just like taking up whatever anybody's coming that from that way.
Got it. And so usually this would be a run play?
Usually this is a pass play. So the quarterback would sprint out. There's usually some different combo going on at the receivers. And if he can't pass it, he just runs the ball out of bounds technically.
Got it. And so when you came in, you said they started kind of installing this as a freshman for you.
Yeah.
To kind of get you kind of on the outside, get you some burn. At what point did they say, we trust you to actually receive the pass and throw it?
So last year it was the last single game last year against Graceland University, it was implemented like the day before the game. It was like that Friday. And it was like, all right, well, we're going to have something just in case we get up a lot or we just need a big play, and we can have some fun with it. It was the same exact people, but it was Connor Perrine. He wasn't at that game. So instead we changed it to Brody Hassel. But we didn't end up running that game because it was a lot closer than we predicted it to be. But they were talking about how they contemplated it through the whole – we had a fourth quarter comeback drive where we scored with like 30 seconds left to win, and they were like, we contemplated it the whole drive, so
trying to do it.
Yeah, they had trust enough in that whole drive to maybe think about doing it. So
Do you have how much quarterback do you have in your background?
None. I was thinking about it yesterday, actually. I've thrown the ball one time in a game otherwise. It was my sophomore year. I was the kicker. So I was the kicker, and it was like a bad snap, and I just threw it in the end zone, and it ended up just getting tipped. So it was like I have one pass under my belt in high school and one pass in college. So,
okay, let's talk about game situation here. You guys are up a ton in when you actually ran it?
During this game, yeah. We were down, actually. We were down 20, I think it was 20-0. And it was kind of one of those things, we'd get past the 50-yard line about every drive, and then we'd always stall out. So they were like, all right, well, at halftime we came in, and he was like, well, if we get past the 50, be ready to run this play, because we need something to get those last yardage. So
that's cool, man. Do you remember down and distance?
I think we just had like a 20-yard gain. It was like a first down. It was a first and 10 play, so...
Get him down, strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah.
No, I dig this. I really dig this. So you had, besides like a Friday walkthrough, you guys never rep this?
The week leading up to this game. Yeah, we ran it every single day.
Okay.
None of them came out as beautiful as that, but they always ended up working a sense of the way, but the ball was never that perfect.
Yeah. And I'm not even just saying this because we're standing here, like, it's a really good ball. Like, you set your feet, you hit him in stride, like, the receiver runs right under it and almost scores. Like, it's a really, really good ball. And that's why I'm like, had you, like, played quarterback in the past? Looks like you know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, I have my other roommate's the backup quarterback. He keeps saying to all of us and like all of our parents and stuff, he goes, I taught him all the time.
Were there any tips in the dorm room? Were there any?
not really at all. It was just like one of those, go out there and huck it. Hope for the best.
See, so look, everybody who says skill players are non-linemen are ridiculous. Like, we have a really, really good big skill player right here in my man, Rube.
There you go. So when you uncork this ball, can you tell when it leaves your hand, like, yeah, I really nailed it? Or are you just like, I hope?
Well, at first, when I first threw it, the point of the play was I was supposed to run up a little bit before, and I looked up and I saw Brody was wide open, and I was just like, all right, I'm going to huck this thing as far as I can. Right. And they were like, only throw it if he's completely open. The defender was a couple yards in front of him. I'm like, all right, this thing's going. I threw it as hard as I could, and I was like, when it first released it, I thought it was overthrown.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shoot, I messed up my chance. And then all of a sudden, Brody caught it. I was like, this is insane. Like, it was crazy that it actually got there.
Were you, if he was not open, would you just eat it and run and try to run?
If he wasn't complete, like, if he was any more covered, like, DB was on him, I was not going to throw it. I was not going to hear it from my offensive coaching staff. They already told me a bunch of times, they're like, if he's not completely open, you're not allowed to throw it.
So I think the funniest thing about this play is, like, the defense is obviously caught off guard, but, like, before you let it go, you're surrounded by, like, four defenders.
Yeah.
And they kind of are like, they don't really rush you. They don't put any pressure on you. So you kind of have enough time to like set and throw. Were you surprised at how kind of you had kind of like a pocket going on here, even though you're on an island by yourself?
Yeah. When we ran it the very first time, there wasn't like that much pocket. Like when we ran it, because the guard was kind of late. And when Durham got there and created that little bit of pocket to take
there's a wide receiver who helps them kind of blocks for Rick.
Yeah, he takes that first one, and then the left guard comes over with me and creates that little bit of like space where he takes up that first guy. And I was just baffled that none of them were just like sprinting at me, just trying to take out my knees like they usually would.
so you guys do score on the next play. The next play?
Yes.
Okay.
We ran inside zone, yeah.
You just ran inside zone?
Yeah, we ran inside zone. It came right up the backside B gap, yeah.
That is crazy. So how much time, did you really have time to like kind of celebrate this or anything like that? Or was it, we got to get on the ball because we want to strike while they are inside and plunge it in?
I actually had a lot of time. Like, think about it. Like, I ran down the field while celebrating. Like,
Thinking
it scored. I'm flailing. I'm going and celebrating with Brody thinking he scored. And he's just, they're like, let's line up. We got to go. I'm like, I'm out of breath now. Like, give me a second here. So.
Awesome. When did you first, like, find out that the Peisman was a thing and that this was going to be, like, potentially a thing that could, you know, go beyond just this game and this moment and become a more like nationally known thing?
It was so right away after the game, I was talking to Coach Sal, and he goes, he didn't bring a Peisman Award. Right. He's like, Brody cost you a big trophy and a trip. And I was like, oh, it's not a big deal. I don't really care. And then it came to the off season where I was talking to Coach Sally about like the All-American stuff and All-Conference stuff. And he was like, dude, we sent your thing into the Peisman Award. It's going to start tomorrow. And actually, like right before that, because I was kind of confused when I was talking to Mr. Atwell, our athletic director. He was like, congrats on the Peisman starting up. And I was like, what does this guy mean? Is he just saying I ate a bunch of pie or something like that? But then when my head coach told me, I was kind of like, wow, this is happening. So
it's cool, man. We should recognize it. NAI All-American, like my guy here, he's got some bona fides.
Yeah.
My guy can ball a little bit. And you know, I think what you want your future to be after you're done playing, you want to coach. I guess kind of tell me about what you kind of want your coaching future to be, because it was kind of interesting talking to you about that.
So what I want to do is after football's over, I want to be a GA somewhere. I want to go to like a bigger D1 school and get that opportunity to get coaching experience while earning the rest of my degree. And then from there, just trying to build up in the ranks, try to get to like an offensive coordinator and eventually try to get to like a head coaching position. I feel like I have like a lot of attributes that those people have, and that I have the perseverance and drive to like get to that point.
Yeah.
Down in my life.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little O-line play just a little bit here and there. For you, would you rather zone blocking or gap blocking?
Zone blocking. We do a lot of zone blocking. I love it a lot more because especially when sometimes in our conference, we have a lot of defensive ends that play four eyes, rock out, the linebacker comes to the B gap when we're running inside zone to the right, and those dudes get eaten up so easily sometimes, and it turns into a pancake across the whole line sometimes. Some of my roommate doesn't like it too much. My roommate's a summer. I pancake a lot of dudes into his knees, and he does not enjoy that. So.
Basically, what Rupe is talking about is, especially if it's a zone to the right and Rupe is on the left side, you know, he would have a defensive lineman over him that, when he says rock out, kind of go, I guess, the opposite way of where the run is coming, and a linebacker would come down. So Rupe is taking a playside step on a zone, and if it's zone to the right, Rupe takes a playside step, goes towards the right, and if there's a linebacker coming down, Rupe is a lot bigger than a linebacker, I can promise you, because I'm sitting across from him right now. And so that's what he's talking about when he talks about getting a pancake on a zone block. So my guy is a zone blocking aficionado. I like to hear that. I guess, are you, when you, in the future, when you kind of get your own offense and you are able to kind of design your own scheme, how important is it to you to establish the run?
I think about it here all the time. We're an air red offense here, so that
misusing you, man.
We pass the ball a lot, but a lot of it's the inside zone reads and stuff like that. But we had our offensive line coach freshman, that was his biggest emphasis, and I was like, I like running this way. I came from a wing tee in high school, so we power, trap, inside zone, outside zone, stuff like that, and that was always the funnest thing. And that's going to be, if I ever come to that position, that's going to be the biggest thing, because that's going to open up the pass game. That's going to open play action, stuff like that. It's going to open up a lot of stuff.
What do you want when you start coaching? Like, what are you most interested to learn? Like, what do you feel like your blind spots are about what you know and what you want to know about the game of football?
My biggest things I want to observe would probably be more of the schemes of like the back, like the DBs and stuff like that, how those fits come in. Because I understand, like, I understand linebacker fits, I understand like D-line fits, but I don't understand when like the safety and stuff, that kind of confuses me at times. That'd be like the biggest thing I think I'd want to like fully learn about.
Basically what Rupe is talking about is like, he, as an offensive lineman, you kind of understand defensive line run fits and linebacker run fits, because those are the guys who are typically in the box, who are typically blocking. But when a DB comes down, that kind of stuff, that's kind of what he's talking about, to kind of explain it a little bit to our audience. This is cool, man. It is. I personally love the Peisman Trophy for the reasons of, like, we can sit here and glorify and celebrate offensive linemen. I was an offensive lineman in high school who was nowhere near as good as you. And so I really love getting offensive linemen some burn and some run publicly. And it's really cool that we have this award that can celebrate the sport in this very, very fun way. Because this is a really cool play, and I really think that you should be really proud of this.
Yeah.
What you guys were able to pull off, man. Are you going to hopefully design some plays like gut in your future offense?
I don't think it's completely out again. So because we tried running it one more time, didn't work out as well as it did because the DB, it was like two games later and the DBs covered the receiver the whole time.
Okay.
So it didn't get to happen. So I ended up running the ball, but I'm thinking by the time next year rolls around, everyone's going to forget about it. It's going to happen again. So
I just think it's great that the secondary respects your talent.
Exactly.
Well, like, I had for like three or four games after that, like the at the time when the play was blown up, we were traveling and we were actually in the locker room, and when like Barstool and like Sunday Night Football were tweeting about it, and we get in the game, they're like, be careful, he's going to pass, and like stuff like that. And they were like, stop and just talk about that. And then like the respect from like the quarterbacks from Benedictine, the team we were playing, he was like, you do the best ball game. Like,
the opposing team's quarterback.
Yeah, the opposing team's quarterback did. So.
Hey, game recognized game.
Yeah.
How many, the time when you ran it, how many yards did you gain?
That second time, 3 yards.
But did you break anybody? Did you put a move on somebody?
So kind of what happened was the left guard came out the same way it did and ended up running. I kind of forgot to tell him he's got to go because like the key word to like if it didn't work out was to go. And he was sitting there just playing around. I sidestepped one kid and then got my knees taken out right after that.
But you put a little move on somebody.
Yeah, I got to the side. I didn't realize it until, like, because I sidestepped them and got like, two or three more yards. And I get off to the sideline, and all the dudes are talking about it. I'm like, what are you talking about? Until I watched the film and realized what happened.
For you, kind of in this whole process, and I guess we gave the award out in December. Like, as all of this is coming, like, what's kind of the wildest, like, thing that's happened to you? Like, you said Sunday Night Football tweeted about it. Like,
yeah.
we gave you this award. Like,
It's got to be between this award, and I got to say it'd be between the Sunday Night Football halftime thing, because that was when the Chiefs were playing the Colts, and this is a big Chiefs area.
Yeah.
So when that happened, like, all the kids from the school, all the kids from, like, other schools were tweeting about it. They were messaging me and stuff like that. It was just, like, I think the biggest thing is, like, all the, like, the relationships I've built through this award and through like the play is the most important aspect to me, but definitely this award, getting it, is the most like recognition I got on campus from a lot of kids. They're like oh you won this award, congrats, type of thing. And then we actually had like a basketball halftime thing where they talked about it, and they had the whole like gym rocking from just talking about it. So it was an amazing experience altogether.
But you haven't seen or gotten the trophy itself yet.
No, I think Atwell has it, right?
Yes, yeah.
So he said he's seen it. He says it's an awesome trophy. I have not personally seen it yet. Okay. And I was sitting there talking to my athletic trainers this morning. I was like, this guy's had the trophy the whole time and I haven't seen it. Like, I've been asking him about it for weeks, and he's acted like he hasn't seen it, hasn't known zip about it until like 2 days ago. And
That's how you can tell somebody has done Christmas for a child before. They're like, there's no toys in this house.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. We're going to let you see that trophy tonight, man. We're going to celebrate you. I cannot wait. This is really fun. And like I said, again, congratulations.
Thank you, guys. It's an awesome experience that you guys get to put together for us, getting that representation for the offensive line that doesn't usually happen. So,
yes, sir. Ryan Nanny, we've crossed the Mississippi River and we've crossed state lines.
Which side are we on now?
We are now in Quincy, Illinois, in the beautiful Fairfield Inn, with a lovely Smoothie King view out the window here. Ryan,
I'm glad this is coming out after we leave, because that is like so specific that somebody could find us and hurt us if they wanted to.
I'm sure our audience in Quincy, Illinois is verbose in their effusive in their praise of the podcast. Ryan, the NCAA transfer waiver working group has proposed a change to the waiver criteria that would allow for first-time transfers to compete immediately in all sports, putting the Big Ten and ACC's favored plan in front of the D1 Council for approval. According to the NCAA, the group's goal is to have the new criteria approved for transfers for the 2021 academic year, a.k.a. this fall, if everything breaks right. This stems from a friend of the program, Nicole Auerbach, did some cool reporting on this yesterday, February 17th. It is now the 18th, and it looks like the NCAA is kind of at least open to relaxing or changing the rules. Welcome to the resistance. More than anything, what we talked about off air, this means the NCAA, like, understands they fucked this up, right?
Let's be more charitable. The NCAA does not want the headache of adjudicating who has a legitimate waiver claim for a transfer and who doesn't, because, like, there is no way to win that. There is no way to sort of say, like, yes, here is the line of hardship, of unfairness or whatever, and, like, these kids are on one side, these kids are on the other side. Like, they were never going to win that battle in the court of public opinion, so they did the smart thing for once and just said, fine, everybody gets candy.
The press release says the working group concept would change waiver criteria to allow approvals for first-time four-year transfers in all sports to compete immediately if they receive a transfer release from their previous school, leave their previous school academically eligible, maintain their academic progress at the new school, leave under no disciplinary suspensions. And there's an addendum lower in the press release. That is where this really gets dicey here. Group members think the waiver process should be limited to truly extenuating and unique circumstances that threaten a student athlete's health and safety. So this really is... the waiver process is not necessarily broken, but it's playing out in a way we didn't anticipate. And we want to kind of leave the waiver process to truly be a waiver process and just kind of allow the floodgates to open.
The other problem is, like, the NCAA, you know, we've talked so often about, like, how many transfer quarterbacks are in the playoff. Like, the NCAA, I think, has had a hard time being like, transferring is bad, and you should only do it under, like, the blah, 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 blah. And, like, also, hey, come watch our college football playoff. It features all these quarterbacks not playing for the schools they originally committed to. What I'm interested in, if you set up this system that basically says the assumption is if your grades are good and if you're not in any trouble, you get a free transfer year. How does that work with schools now who say, like, if you're at Florida and you want to transfer, Florida says, cool, we will sign that as long as you don't transfer within the division or against an opponent we're going to play in the next 4 years. Like, is that still cool? Or are schools going to be expected to say, no, player autonomy is a thing. If you have a kid who wants to go play for Kentucky, let him go play for Kentucky and don't get in his way.
That is the thing that schools are going to want to retain transfer restrictions. Right. Again, transfer restrictions are ridiculous. Any college football coach right now could go to any other school. We just saw it happen. As long as the money's right, they can go within their division. They can go within their conference. It does not matter. There are no restrictions for
Florida.
Them.
Florida paid Will Muschamp to be Auburn's defensive coordinator. They were paying his bills while he did that.
You love to see it. And so, yeah, that's what the schools are going to push back on. The schools are going to push back and say, we don't, and I guess no matter how this rule is written or passed, it still says receive a transfer release from their previous school. My question is, do schools in 2020 want the smoke of transfer restrictions?
Right.
Because it seems that they haven't recently, because it's the same, like, Bill Snyder tried to block some kid a couple years ago. Mike Gundy did it a few years ago. I think Georgia did it a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It becomes a thing where the school tries to put the restriction out, then it gets out that the school tried to put the restriction out, everybody freaks out, and then they relent. So I guess it's going to be up to the schools now to say what it is they want to happen here or what it is that they care about. You know, schools have shown that they won't block, like, a Tate Martell situation for a player who's not going to be on the team.
And who's not going to play for one of your opponents.
Yes. But this also does let the Big Ten and the ACC say, hey, we were out in front of this as arbiters of college sports.
Mm-hmm. we are the moral authority, so to speak. But it's also hard to ignore that some schools in those conferences have been bitten by this. Like, I can think of multiple Virginia Tech attempted transfers who didn't get a waiver. And then you think about, like, yeah, Virginia Tech is probably a school that could have used a little bit of help through the waiver process, and them not getting it. I'm sure they were pissed. Like, there was, you know, our colleague Alex Kirshner made this flowchart about, like, when whether or not you'll get your waiver approved. And it's not really a joke. Like, there is no sort of certain way to look at something and say, yes, that one's going to let you play next year, this one won't. And so, ultimately, I think it's cleaner and easier for everybody that the NCAA is at least leaning this direction.
What happens to the lawyers? What happens to the lawyers who have made a decent living or a decent carve-out for helping players get the waivers?
I'm confident savvy lawyers will find a way.
What's the way the NCAA screws this up here?
Screws this one up specifically?
Yeah, this on its face good rule that a lot of us have been pining for and is frankly a successor to immediate grad transfers.
I think they might not. Like, the thing this actually makes me think of is way, way back. This is even before, if you can believe it, I was a cognizant college football fan. But, like, freshmen initially weren't allowed to play college football. Like,
yeah, they had to be on freshmen.
Right. You had to sit out. You could not play on the varsity. And eventually the NCAA just did away with that. And, like, look, that's not a thing that necessarily is, like, hugely impacting rosters year to year. But most good teams have one freshman or a couple freshmen who, like, A, are really good, or B, just have to play because of injury. And, like, that's just the thing that they did and has gone pretty well. And that's another example, I think, where they said, well, we're doing this to protect academic integrity, blah, 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 blah. Now that they've done it, I don't think anybody looks back and says, ugh, if only we restricted it and didn't let freshmen play anymore.
All right. Speaking of transfers and speaking of sitting out, okay, Joe Burrow's not going to sit. Joe Burrow's not going to not play for the Bengals. I don't think we should actually entertain that. Basically,
you don't think he'll hold them to the fire?
I do not think
okay,
so.
Okay.
Joe Burrow has this
give
week.
Me, give me a. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead and give me context.
Joe Burrow this week was in Fort Worth receiving the Davey O'Brien Award and basically says. He said, and I quote, "I do have leverage" when asked about, like, the draft process, because Cincinnati obviously is his presumed destination. It's February 18th in the early evening when we're recording this. We're a week away from the combine. The quote is, "The Bengals have their process. I have my process. We haven't even gotten to the NFL combine yet. There's a lot of things that can happen leading up to the draft and a lot of information gathered. In my opinion, it is much ado about nothing." But it is the noteworthiness here is that apparently Joe Burrow's, like, mom was caught off guard by these comments. Robin Burrow said, "We have no idea where that comes from. It's a story out there that someone has created and doesn't have any substance from our perspective, at least. Anybody listening to this podcast maybe 2 weeks ago knows that sometimes young men say something about where they're going to play football that their parents or grandparents may not necessarily know. Young men can always surprise you."
And then you throw agents into the mix, too.
And then you throw agents into the mix. But I don't think – what's Joe Burrow going to do here? Honestly. Joe Burrow – if Joe Burrow somehow convinces the Bengals not to take him.
Right.
Washington is at 2. They probably will not take him.
No.
Depending on what Detroit does with Matt Stafford – Detroit could take him.
Indications seem to be that Matt Stafford is staying in Detroit.
Sure. I think there right now is there is some rumblings that they may get rid of him. But the other thing is there are also rumblings that they've been shopping Darius Slay at cornerback, which means they're going to need a cornerback. Jeffrey Okuda is going to be right there at 3. The Giants are not going to take him at 4. Then we get to the Dolphins.
Right.
And then we get to the Chargers, who may or may not have Tom Brady, Tyrod Taylor. Then we get to the Panthers, who may or may not have Cam Newton.
Sure. Like, that's the interesting thing, is the farther down you go, it's not really about, like, well, where would he slip? Would they just take somebody else? It's more just, to me, it's more like, who would trade up?
Right, right.
And because, like, there are a couple examples you can use here from history. One, of course, is Eli Manning telling the Chargers.
Oh, we'll get there because I'm very interested in how that played out.
But regale me. But, like, Bo Jackson drafted first overall by the Tampa Bay Bucks, said, "I will not play for you." The TLDR version is he was convinced they wrecked his baseball career and wrecked his eligibility at Auburn. Like, and just didn't play for a year, like sat out of the NFL for a year, went back into the draft and got picked in the seventh round by the Raiders. Now, I don't think that's the path that Joe Burrow should take, but like John Elway didn't want to play for the Colts. Like
John Elway said he was going to go play for the Yankees.
John Elway said he would go play baseball instead of play for the Colts.
And the Colts did not take him,
and
right?
And the Colts, I believe, traded that pick, if memory serves.
Basketball, Kobe Bryant told John Calipari not to take him with the Nets, and Calipari took, where they take Kelvin Kittles or something?
Yeah, it's
it was like a serviceable pro that wasn't Kobe Bryant.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I am just interested in the... What do you think the leverage actually is in 2020's NFL for Joe Burrow?
So the only way I see the leverage happening is if your agent can go and find a successful trade partner. Because, like, yes, the Bengals would really, really like to have Joe Burrow. Does that mean that they will take him to the exclusion of any offer whatsoever? No. I think most organizations are smart enough to be like, yeah, we'll listen to that. Like, Joe Burrow's really good, and maybe he is a franchise-changing quarterback, but you ain't number one in the draft order because you only need one piece. So, like, if they can go out and find a Miami or somebody who is like, hey, we will give you three first-rounders, two first-rounders and three second, whatever, like, the bounty is that you can get back, like... You know, the other example I think of here is you go back and you look at this. This also involved the Bengals, I believe. All the picks that the Saints gave up
to get
Ricky Williams. Yeah. And like you look back and like there is an opportunity there that I think a team like at least would entertain, especially if you think like, ugh, this is going to be rocky and miserable from like day one. Maybe you talk about it, but. Unless you have that other team that's willing to be like in this weird draft love triangle with you, you really like your leverage is pretty slim.
I do think this is, if anything else, I do think this could be a very clear message to the Bengals to say, hey, you guys better figure it out with AJ Green.
Right.
Like you better figure it out. AJ Green is a free agent or will be a free agent when the new league year starts in a few weeks. Right now the Bengals could let him go or not try to retain him or what have you. If I'm Joe Burrow, I'm like, look, you better figure it out with somebody for me to throw to. Now I've got a really good running back in Joe Mixon. There are offensive pieces around him, particularly because Mixon catches the ball out of the backfield. There are pieces around him, I think. I'm not sure what's happening with Tyler Eifert. But if the message is retain your parts so that I can come in here year one and we can do something in this division, then I think that could be fun. But I do not end up, I do not actually think Joe Burrow really and truly stiff Cincinnati. I don't know. I just don't really see it.
I think this is the kind of thing you can say at this point in the process, before, like he said, before the combines even happen, like it's vague enough that you can sort of wipe it clean. I will say, if you hear it a second time, you hear it a third time, then you start to approach like, yes, the point of no return.
Now it's sort of like he wasn't effusive in saying he wanted to go. So now it's like, we're talking about it. We're kicking it around in purely hypothetical.
There's also like the draft in some ways. Yes, it's like a talent acquisition process. It's also a marketing process. And if you have the first pick, you want your fans to be fired up about who you take.
Particularly this first pick with this guy. Everybody in Ohio, you know, conceivably a lot of them are Cavs fans. Right. A lot of them went through the LeBron things more than
right,
once.
Right.
Like this is the Bengals, I think, have a pretty – don't screw this up.
The last thing you want is a sea of probably drunk – Bengals fans in Las Vegas booing because you took Joe Burrow, who said he didn't want to play for you.
Yeah.
And then booing when Joe Burrow has the natural adjustment that comes with being a rookie quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah.
Like you actively don't want that.
If I'm Zach Taylor though, I'm like, look, man, give me the quarterback.
Yeah.
If I'm Zach Taylor, I'm like, I want the quarterback. That's why I'm here. You guys, you know, gave me Andy Dalton. It didn't really work out. But I also, I wanted to go back to the Eli thing just because I'm fascinated
yeah.
that we, The Manning family, I think, is interesting in this respect because Archie told a team to fuck off.
Right.
Eli did it too.
Right.
Now they've got this nephew that in 4 or 5 years you're going to hear about Arch. As the anointed one, Arch. But I want to talk about Eli because it's something that I don't really remember happening. But obviously Eli's retired now. And it's kind of like when we look back on his career, it's kind of funny because it worked out for both parties involved.
Right. So I think part of what I remember, and I was still like, this was what, 99?
No, it was later than that, right?
Was it later than that? Am I just incredibly?
Because I remember Eli Manning a little bit of
Ole Miss. Sorry, 2004.
Yeah.
It's 2004. Right. So yeah, I am old enough to actually remember this in some detail. I apologize. It felt actually not that hostile. I think in part because everybody was pretty upfront. Like there wasn't this sort of like, well, I'm kind of, it was just sort of like, nope, don't want to play for you. Just doesn't want to happen. And because in that draft in particular, the Chargers, I think, knew like, okay, yeah, we'd like to have Eli Manning. He's the number one pick for a reason, but there's a very good quarterback. There are several very good quarterbacks.
Roethlisberger was also in that draft. Right, obviously, exactly. Philip Rivers.
So like,
and J.P. Lossman.
Right. So I think the question here is like, okay, if you're the Bengals and you cannot, and you're just, he's not playing for you. Joe Burrow's not playing for you. Are you happy if you can get to a position and take Tua? Like, is that a position where you can say, okay, because at the end of that trade, the Chargers could go back to their fans and say, look, we got a good quarterback and we ended up getting Sean Merriman and we ended up getting, I think, Nate Kaning with
the picks.
Yeah. So like you could make a case that this was still good for our team. We did not get screwed or fleeced or, you know, we didn't bust out.
So but the alternative for the Bengals is what? The alternative for the Bengals is somebody gives you a God's sweetheart deal. Hopefully right. Dolphins.
Sure, whoever it is.
Whoever it
really
is.
Doesn't matter. As long as like you're getting the package value of picks that you can justify passing up on maybe the best quarterback you're going to have the chance to take at the first. Because that's the other thing is it's not just like it's the first pick. It's the one where you have all the control in the world. And it's very, I think it's very hard for teams to accept that like maybe that's not true.
This the draft, I love reading back on first rounds of the draft. Chargers Eli Manning, obviously we know how that goes. Oakland Raiders Robert Gallery,
yes,
Iowa,
yes.
Arizona Cardinals Larry Fitzgerald, the Giants Philip Rivers.
Robert Gallery was like such a huge pick.
I remember that.
Yes.
I remember that. That I do remember as like, oh, the Raiders took like
this
foundational
is a game-changing, yes,
left tackle. Washington takes Sean Taylor. Cleveland, Kellen Winslow. Detroit takes Roy Williams. Atlanta Falcons, D'Angelo Hall. My dearly beloved Jacksonville Jaguars take Reggie Williams. Houston, Dante Robinson. And then Pittsburgh takes Ben Roethlisberger at 11. And that kind of, you know, finishes out that cycle of those three quarterbacks.
How many defensive players are there in that list you just, because it.
There is one, two.
Two. Sean Taylor.
Three.
Sean Taylor,
D'Angelo Hall, and Dante Robinson.
That's like, that feels very weird now.
Yeah.
Like we had a top 10, we had 10 draft picks and only three of them were defensive players.
Jonathan Vilma gets taken next at 12.
Yeah. By the
and
Jets.
Then there's a tackle, two ends.
Right.
Will Forks in here.
But like there's a bunch of wide receivers.
There's a bunch of wide receivers.
Yeah.
Bunch of running backs.
Yeah.
It is funny to see that shakeout. So there's Joe Burrow's there's Joe Burrow's leverage. Let's have fun with that over the next 2 months of the draft industrial complex. All right. Ask PAPN. At N Schlutt, I am probably butchering that, has a question. Can I morally continue to root for the Razorbacks with Kendall Briles on staff?
That is like a tough question. And I would like to, without backpatting too much, it's good that you're asking that.
Yeah.
It's good that you are wondering that. I think ultimately the answer is yes, but.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, but only if you are sort of asking the right questions and not just sort of being out there defending your team. Because I think ultimately what we look at from a fan perspective, because fans are not the people who control university policy or responses to lawsuits or responses to allegations of sexual assault. what fans can control is their public reaction to defend their school or not. And I think what your obligation is as a fan, and what our obligations as fans are, is to not do the knee-jerk thing where somebody says something, Arkansas may have screwed something up, and you're out there on the front lines of Twitter defending the honor of this institution that I presume does not pay you a dime. Like, as long as you're not that person and you are thoughtful about holding the power structures at the school you root for accountable for the choices they make, I think you can be more okay with it. I think that also means that you have the right to sort of, like, wherever possible, sort of ask how this happened. Like, how does Kendall Briles get this job? What kind of vetting process goes on? That's not a thing a fan can necessarily do easily, but, like, it's an important conversation, I think, to have with other people who you know who root for Arkansas.
Kendall Briles is interesting in the – I think Art Briles has become such the boogeyman. He is the boogeyman.
He's the polarizing that we take, center.
Yeah, he is the boogeyman that we have taken from the Baylor scandal. The Baylor scandal was now, what, 4 years ago?
That
5 years?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And so now we are removed enough from it. And Baylor, as a football program, is now three coaches away from it, that we – I'm not saying we let Baylor off the hook here, but – The takeaway from the Baylor scandal, I think, centers so clearly around Art Briles, primarily because of what Art Briles was to that program, what college football coaches are to their program as the Sun, Moon, and Stars in a way that they aren't really in other sports, probably besides college basketball. And Kendall Briles skated. Kendall Briles' reputation, comparatively, has skated, has And Kendall Briles was not a saint after Art like got suspended. He was wearing like the Coach Art Briles stuff right. on his hands and all that sort of stuff. It is interesting when we talk about how we talk about Baylor and the fallout of it, how Kendall Briles has this is Kendall Briles' third job?
FAU, FSU here.
Yeah, this will be okay. Kendall Briles' third job post Baylor.
Right.
And it's just the thing that I think is interesting in part of the fallout that we can kind of have this conversation. And look, I'm not going to try to legislate somebody's fandom here. You know, if we love a sport that is quite problematic for a lot of reasons.
I don't know what to do about the fact that Kendall Briles has had three stops since he left Baylor. The way Baylor handled that investigation with the oral report
yes.
and the not really disclosing much of anything as much as they could, it's still very hard to tell, like, this is exactly – we only have sort of like
– Who did – we do not really know who did or who didn't do correct. What outside of our brows.
And in some ways, the responsibility since then, I would argue – is not even entirely on Kendall Briles. It's on the institutions that are never held to task. Like, nobody's went to FAU and was like, stand accountable for the decision you've made. Didn't happen at FSU. Hasn't happened at Arkansas so far that I'm aware of. It's possible that there's something I haven't. And so ultimately, like, Arkansas is just as wrong as those has failed in the same way that those other institutions have.
Right. There is something of there is something to the systemic nature of how coaches churn.
Right.
That lets this kind of
Can I throw like a real weird curveball at you?
Please do.
Here? The example that has stuck with me in this coaching cycle is at LSU with Bo Pelini.
Yeah.
Bo Pelini went, like, to paraphrase it somewhat, went to great lengths to bring one of the two Steubenville rapists onto the Youngstown State team. He was at this was a player who had gone to a different college after high school and had come to Youngstown State, but had not transferred as a football player. And he like went and sought him out and tried to get him on the team. And you know, it was a thing on the internet for like the month or two that it was in the news. But when Bo Pelini got the LSU defensive coordinator job, nobody, including like thoughtful members of media Twitter, nobody was out here saying, okay, well, do we have any questions now that Bo Pelini is back in the national spotlight about, like, that decision, how it went, what he learned from it? Like, it's not even a topic of conversation. And I think that ultimately is, like, I would actually much rather Arkansas come out and say, we hired Kendall Briles because he has taken these steps to be more responsible with the student population. We think he can be an asset to helping us thoughtfully and meaningfully deal with sexual assault on campus because of X, Y, and Z. I would rather hear that. Like, that at least would be engaging with the topic in a meaningful way. And instead, we just sort of, like, refer to it obtusely on social media or on websites or whatever, and we don't really get into it in any way whatsoever. You and other people can talk, like, thoughtfully and eloquently and with knowledge about, like, Kendall Briles offensive play caller, because there is a record, there is, like,
you're gonna
product.
Get a lot of screens, baby.
Sure. Like, you can do that. It is wild to the point of irresponsibility that we cannot do that. Like, we cannot even do subpoint one on Kendall Briles' statutory responder.
Yeah.
Statutory reporter. Yeah. Like, that I think ultimately is what goes to this question. This question is that it's,
we don't really, and correct me if I'm extrapolating the point too far,
right,
but we don't really know what Kendall Briles did or didn't do. Is that where we're going?
It's
there?
Not even that. It's that we don't know, like, has anything changed since then?
Yes.
Like,
has Kendall learned something?
Here's a good counterexample. Mike Riley,
okay,
at Oregon State had a situation where he basically underplayed a sexual assault involving Brenda Tracy.
Yes.
Like, that's where Brenda Tracy's that's where her sort of work
began.
Sort of the, like, sad and traumatic origin
Genesis,
story.
Yeah.
Exactly. But since then, working with people like Brenda Tracy, Mike Riley has sort of gone out and said, like, this is, like, how I have tried to do better. This is what I try to tell the kids that I work with now. There hasn't been shit about that from Kendall Briles. So it's impossible to give him or the schools that he's worked for benefit of the doubt that is completely unearned. And so, like, I guess where I am way circling around to is, you should not necessarily feel that Arkansas is the worst actor of all of them. You should do your best to hold yourself and others around you accountable for at least thoughtfully engaging with this when and where you can.
Yeah. And I think there are legitimate conversations in the Arkansas college football in general, but as an Arkansas fan base, there are and should be considerable conversations about what it is we are talking about when we talk about Arkansas's coaching staff, Kendall Briles, mm-hmm, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's that. If Celebrity Hot Tub had the power to do so, what's one CFB rivalry he'd stop playing and one he'd start back up? That comes from @namebrandcereal.
Huh. Do you want me to how do you want me to treat conferences in this? Like, do you want me to fuck with conference games?
I would. Yeah, why not?
Wow. Okay. I want Florida State Miami to take a break.
Take a break?
Yeah. And
We were talking about Miami in the car ride over.
I want Florida State Miami to take a break, not because it can't be a compelling football game and not because I'm saying anything about the state of either program, but because I think there are some rivalries that if you take a little break and sort of let the pressure cooker build up a little bit, I think that will make for something more interesting. Florida State Miami right now has lost its luster so badly. And granted, it was a luster
Florida
that was,
State fans would disagree.
Well, I mean, fair, but it was a luster that was so high at one point.
Yeah.
And I think if we said, you know what, we're just going to give it like 3 years off.
Yeah.
And we know it's coming back and we know when we're coming back to it. Like, I think that would be a good way to inject a little more gravitas and emotion into the thing.
Remember what Florida State, I think people need to remember what Florida State and Miami's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be number 2 versus number 5, and you trade which one is which.
Exactly. Florida State and Miami is supposed to be the ACC's marquee game Bar none. Yes. It is why the ACC's divisions are aligned the way that they are. It is why Miami is in this conference. The league literally said, we want to create a league that has that football rivalry as the center.
As the gravitational pull.
And 15 years have elapsed, and we understand what Clemson is now, and Florida State Clemson was the sun, moon, and stars for a little bit.
Right.
But Florida State Miami has, I would argue, what year did Miami join the ACC? 2004?
That's, yeah, right around
2004 or 2005.
Yeah.
Miami joins the ACC.
Yeah.
I would argue it has never in 15 years actually lived up to the hype by the time you got to the end of the season.
Right.
Because Miami had a few years in like Jameis Winston era Florida State Miami rivalry where Miami was like undefeated.
Hot out the gate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Undefeated, 6-0, went to Tallahassee. Cliff.
Well, that was the thing. They'd lose to Florida State and then they fall apart.
Exactly.
Right.
There was the year that they beat Florida State barely in Miami, Rick's first year. That was the good year where they were whatever. They were in the ACC championship game, whatever. But the game has never lived up to the luster. I think that's a funny one. What are you bringing back?
I mean, West Virginia Pitt is a really obvious one that like would be very dear to my heart. And I know that game is sort of coming back, at least in a limited capacity. I like that Nebraska, Oklahoma, granted it's not going to be for a while, but I'm glad that it's coming back. And I would actually like to see, this is sort of a more general answer. I really like, in the same way, maybe this is a good way to trade it. I liked the West Coast Miami games. Like I liked when
Miami was playing like Washington.
Yes. Or when they were playing like UCLA. Like I still vividly remember Cade McNown and UCLA playing just one of the worst games they've ever played against a good Miami team. And like there was something about those games that I think fits. So I don't know, like, give me a UCLA-Miami rivalry. Like, yeah. Let's just do it. Let's just do, like, and we can call it, like, weren't the 90s great? Like, that'll be the name of the rivalry.
I do think, like, my answer to this question is always so basic, and I don't care. It is still Texas and Texas A&M.
Yeah.
Primarily because of what the game could be in the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
Because of what Jimbo Fisher is being paid, because of the reckoning that Tom Herman may run into if he doesn't figure it out in another year or two, I would love for the game to again be able to, particularly because they're not in the same league, I would love for the game to come and be this build to the end of the season and then be able to topple these two teams' seasons and ergo off seasons in a way that it hasn't because we've taken the time off. And we've understood that the two teams have grown apart and whatever. And Texas A&M has gone on to greener pastures, so they say, with all this money and all this kind of stuff. I just think the game is now even funnier than it was before. But it's also funny the way it ended.
Yeah, it is.
It's also very funny the way it ended, if that is the way it will end for all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I will skip to our last here, just because I think it's just interesting to kind of talk to our audience and level with them. At JMW918 asks, always been curious, do y'all work 7 days a week during college football season? If not, when is your Saturday? Always been curious, do y'all work... that's a double copy and paste. The question is what's our work schedule?
So this, in my experience... This question varies wildly depending on A, how old you are, and B, what your relationship status is.
Yes, / how many children you have, apparently. Right.
So the older you are and the more you are in like committed relationships, being married, having children, whatever, I think it resembles more of like, I don't know, let's call it like a 5.5, maybe 6 day work week, depending, where you sort of pick your spots. You try to take some days off in the middle of the week when you can sort of say like, this is when things will be lighter. But like, that's the I think that's the aspiration. And the thing I try to do, and Richard can call me out on it or not, is sort of like try to say, no, this is a job. We should work 5 days a week, take days off in the middle of the week, take vacation time in the middle of the season if you want. Like, I firmly believe that there is no reason why, because you cover college football, you have to be plugged into it all of the time, watch every game possible. Like, I don't think that actually makes you smarter, more thoughtful,
I think people, more aware. I think people like to say that they do that.
Sure. I genuinely believe there are some people in college football media who do like to do that. And if that's your thing, that's your thing, and that's cool. But
Jason,
like,
has a joke about Maxion that we all say we watch Maxion, and no one actually watches Maxion. I just think it's funny. I hate working on Fridays. Mm-hmm. I hate it with a passion. During the season, during the off season, I don't love it that much either. But I do not mind kind of selling my whole Saturday. That's fine. That's a job. But I would rather not work Friday. I try to orient my schedule where it's Saturday is in essence the beginning of my week, so to speak.
It's your Monday.
It's my Monday. And
it's a long ass Monday.
Yeah. And Sunday mornings, I wake up at like 7 a.m. on Sunday mornings and prep. I'll catch up on the Hawaii game or the late night Pac-12 after dark game that I checked out at a halftime or whatever. And I wake up on Sunday and prep all that stuff. I'm not the only college football podcaster that does that. If you listen to the Solid Verbal, you would be surprised at what time Dan Rubenstein goes to bed. I also like to have my work kind of done by Sunday afternoon, because I do like to watch the Jags game. I do like to watch the NFL. It's funny, I have, since becoming a more prominent member in the college football media, started to love the NFL in a way that I really never have.
Well, also the Jags were good for a season.
Also, the Jags
and
got good that season.
Back on the bandwagon.
And look where it got me now, 3 years later. Jesus. 2 years later. And so now I do like to watch the NFL. I do like to take the back half of my Sundays to watch the NFL with my friends, you know, go to a bar or what have you. And then Monday through Thursday-ish, work as usual.
There's also this, like, the weird thing about being in, this is true, I think, about anybody who works in sports, is there's this weird, like, am I working or not?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
If there's a Thursday night game and Twitter's like, hey, this doesn't happen that much anymore, but if there's like a Saturday noon game that I wasn't planning on working and whatever, and somebody's like, hey, you got to turn this game, Army is like taking it to Michigan.
Yeah.
And I turn it on and I'm just like, I'm not writing anything for it. I'm just sort of watching it. Like, am I working or not? And I honestly don't know the answer sometimes. Like, because we cover a thing that we love, and because we would, I don't think we would spend Saturdays the exact way we spend them now, starting at the hours we do and ending at the hours that we do. But it's not like, I don't think any of us are in this and are like, I watch college football because it's my job.
I think
we watch college football and it's our job.
Yeah.
And so it can be kind of hard to tell, like Saturdays especially. What I try to do in that case is sort of like self triage, and if it's like it's the primetime game and like the Ohio State Nebraska game this year, I just bailed.
Yeah,
because bail halftime. Like, what am I going to see in the second half that like I have to do? I am not the kind of person who can be like, oh, this is what I saw in this. Like, I know I'm not that person, so I would rather go spend that hour like feeding my kid dinner, or spending some time with my wife and pretending like I like. I'm a balanced person.
Yeah. I would just like to say, in short, God bless you and hug your local condensed game YouTuber.
Oh, yeah.
The moment you see them.
The kindest people in the world.